at first sight, you think it's quite superficial, don't you? I mean, you think a museum of broken relationships, I mean, sounds a bit tacky. But then it's so interesting as a museum because it shows, like, anthropologically, the need in the world at the moment for museums like this. You know, a lot of the people that have donated objects, you get the feeling that they needed to kind of donate objects.
Welcome to Zeitnopod. On the microphone, Tanja Luchsinger. About 10 years ago, during a vacation in Croatia, I found myself in Zagreb. Wandering the city with no particular destination, I stumbled upon a museum with an enchanting name, the Museum of Broken Relationships. Inside, I discovered a collection unlike any other. The museum displays ordinary objects, soft toys, a hockey puck, a stiletto, even a vibrator that once played a role in someone's relationship. Each item is accompanied by a short note, where it came from, how long the relationship lasted, and a glimpse into the story behind it. What struck me most was not just the objects themselves, but what they represented. They were the kinds of things that remain in people's possession long after a relationship has ended. Too charged with meaning to throw away, yet often too painful to keep. And so they are sent to the Museum of Broken Relationships, transformed from private relics into shared stories. On that day in Zagreb, I spent hours reading these notes of love, loss, and memory. That same year, I encountered the museum again when it exhibited part of its collection in Basel. Even now, almost a decade after my first visit, I remain deeply moved by the idea behind the museum and its objects. This year, with the Zetno team Desire Discarded, I saw an opportunity to return to it once more. By now, the museum has collected thousands of contributions from people around the world and exhibited in countless cities all over the globe, an ever-growing archive of once desired objects that, through being discarded, found a new home and a new meaning. In this episode, I'm going to speak to the founders of the Museum of Broken Relationships, Olinka Vistica and Dražen Grubišić, as well as to anthropologist Adam Drazen.
Four discs, May 2008 through January 10th, 2009, Richmond, Virginia. In 2008, I was 62, he was 34. I was not looking for him, he was not looking for me. The universe opened a door and we walked through it. He gave me a magical time. On January 10th, I let him go. I let him go not because I wanted the magic to end, but it was the best ending for a relationship that was destined to end the day it began. After I die, my family will be sorting through what's left behind of my life, and they will not find Mr. 34. I've removed all the evidence and stored the memories in my heart, except for these four discs of music. Mr. 34 put this music together and gave it to me because he wanted to give me something important. He wanted to give me something he loved. He gave me music. Giving these discs to you honors him, and it honors a broken heart. Thank you.
I am very excited to be joined today by the founders of the Museum of Broken Relationships. To kick things off, could you quickly introduce yourselves?
I'm Dražen Grubišić, visual artist by education and vocation.
And my name is Olinka Vistica. I don't know, I've done many different things in my life, loving stories, people, languages. So I worked in the film industry, culture and arts.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I would like to hear the origin story. How did the idea of the museum come about?
You know that stories change with time. So to tell you the answer to that question, we have to go back almost more than 20 years. So the memory changes the story. So, but the basic facts are maybe the same. So we were a couple like 30 years ago and living together, having fun, traveling, you know, all the things you do in a relationship. But then we were no exception also in that way that our relationships just ran out of fuel, to say that, and we decided to break up, which was not an easy thing to do. So we talked a lot, and today we could say we tortured ourselves what, how to say goodbye, but at the same time try to keep the good times alive in a way. And that gave birth to this obsessive question: so when the relationship dies, where does 21 gram of its soul go? Does that energy disappear? So, and we were in the house we lived in, we were surrounded by the objects that kind of witnessed our times together. And then one material banal object, which was a wind-up bunny, which was a substitute for a pet we never had, and the many memories of our travels, of our times together, were kind of as locked in that little wind-up toy. And we thought, okay, maybe the soul of the relationships is in the bunny, because it was some kind of a fusion of a present regrets and the joy we felt during the relationship. So, and that gave birth to an idea that maybe we are not alone in this quest for, you know, looking for a way to preserve the love, which is no longer supported by the lives of its protagonists. So we thought maybe we could offer to others also the same idea: send us an object from a relationship that is no longer alive, and in that way get rid of the burden, make it like a ritual of letting go, but at the same time it will continue to live in a space that we imagine. It was an imaginary space, and we called it Museum of Broken Relationships. And then we were not together for a couple of years. And then Dražen called me one day and said, there is this art show, maybe we could apply, which we did. And that was the first exhibition of the Museum of Broken Relationship.
And we asked our friends and their friends if they have something. So that was how we got to hold of the first 46 objects. And for that, for us, that was it. This exhibition was supposed to be it. But then it just exploded. And so 20 years later, we have two locations. The one in Zagreb is one of the most visited museums in Croatia, which still amuses me. And yeah, so you never know how things turn out.
And what was most surprising to you when the first objects and stories started to arrive?
We had doubts, because when you're an artist, usually you oversee all process from the beginning to the end, and you're in total control. And this was something where you have absolutely no control, because it's a crowdsourced project. So whatever people give you, so it can be whatever. So we had doubts like, oh, it will be boring, it will be repetitive, it will be just letters and plush toys and, you know, some silly notes. And then we got first 46 objects, and it was just crazy. Like, Olinka met with a guy in a bar, and he took out the plastic shopping bag and pulled out the prosthesis, underneath prosthesis. Like, you really do not expect that. So It was very varied. It was it showed how people are different. So there was no repetition. It was definitely not boring. So yeah, it turned out really well.
For me, the most, let's say, surprising thing was to see that people still hold on to some memories of something that happened a long time ago. And I remember I met with a woman from a small town near Zagreb. She came to Zagreb to meet me, you know, these meeting points in the cities under the city clock. And she came with her husband now, but she gave us a diary of her, I don't know, of love in her 20s. That was kind of from the first page to the last page, it was full of his name, but she kind of really wanted, she kept it for so long and then came with her husband to Zagreb to kind of entrust it to us. So that was really special, you know. We felt like, okay, but that was a big responsibility also.
I totally agree. These are truly incredible stories you are entrusted with. You already said it a little bit, but what are the typical things that people send in and what are the unusual ones? Are there any patterns?
There are always the things that you would expect. So the wedding rings and wedding gowns, that's something you expect. So, of course, we have those in a bigger number than the rest. But everything else, it's really surprising how varied it can be, from parachutes to, you know, little post-it notes to tickets to, I mean, what you just turn around in your room, whatever you see, we have it. That's sort of, and also we had some things we could not accommodate. There was an offer for a grand piano from London, a bus from Sweden, a Jeep from Korea. So, yeah, it was interesting that there are these objects that possess such a strong emotional energy, but just for those two people, nobody else in the world. For everybody else, it's a banal thing. It's nothing. And for you, when you see it, it gets such a rush of emotions. That was really interesting. And so how can you tell the story of this object? That was the idea.
How many objects are part of your collection by now? And is there a particular object or story that has stayed with you over the years?
Many. Many, yeah, really.
Yeah. The collection is now like 4,000 pieces. But it's hard to pick one object. I like very much this, it's called Sweater of Indecision. And it's a handmade piece. And the person who sent it said that kind of she knitted away the sweater while thinking of the guy that left her, I don't know, for a younger student, and that he wanted her to knit him a sweater, but he kept changing his mind. He wanted, I don't know, this type of color, a pocket here. And in the end, when he left, she pursued with knitting of the sweater, which she says is a kind of reflection of a possessive and broken person he is. So you see this piece, which is beautiful, actually, but I think it's a very telling piece. So that's that one, but yeah, many.
I mean, it takes us, when we change the display, we do it every couple of years, and then we change everything. And when we do it, it takes us about a year to decide. It's that's hard. So just like picking one, and this is like we pick 100. So maybe one that your listeners would not expect, because everybody thinks it's just a romantic relationship. It talks of loss of friendship, disappointment in friends. When you have a good circle of friends and it lasts for long, and then they do something. It was a lottery ticket. Sort of lottery ticket. And usually, you know, they always played this as a ritual together. And then she found out that they played without her, and that actually
and that's
she was kind of pushed out of the circle.
how she found out, because they won.
They won, yeah. And I can imagine how terrible you must feel.
Why do you think people send objects in, and what are the reasons? I'm sure there are many.
As you said, there are many reasons. So sometimes it is, I want to move this away from my place where it reminds me, so it's somewhere else. But more often now it becomes sort of, when you look back at your life, we have a lot of those. When you look back at your life and then you realize that then, 20, 30 years ago, that was the biggest love that you had. And you lost it, and you kind of want to immortalize it, and then you send it to us.
But I think that there is this kind of paradoxical thing you want when you are freshly hurt and feeling alone. You want to forget, you want to get rid of that feeling, and you want to, let's say, cure. And but at the same time, this is what happened with us. You are kind of lingering to that because you don't want to lose that story. And what the museum gives you an opportunity to share it with others, I think, because now the museum is a place where those stories are going to be read by hundreds of thousands of visitors. You know, there would be one person hunched over your story, and it would mean something. People say that kind of moves them. So I think this moment of sharing, and in our times, it's very hard. We share, we curate our lives on social platforms, but this vulnerable part we rarely show in public. And at the museum you have this space which is protected, where this vulnerability is shown with dignity.
Actually, when I prepared for this podcast, I reread your book again, and something really stayed with me that you wrote, Olinka. You were writing that melancholy has been unjustly banished from the public space, and that it should have the right to exist and even be celebrated. In that sense, the museum is often described as a kind of shrine to failed relationships, or a space for a form of public mourning of what is usually a very private experience. I found this super interesting and really fitting. And maybe a bit related to that, I was also struck by something almost voyeuristic about the exhibition. I found myself getting a bit addicted to reading one deeply intimate, if anonymous, story after the other. And yet, at the same time, it sent me, like probably every visitor, on my own emotional journey, because it's surprising how many of these experiences actually resonate. How do you think about that tension between voyeurism and personal identification in the way people engage with the museum?
I think it's a very deeply human trait. It's, voyeuristic, it may sound wrong, but this is the way we also learn. It's somebody else's experience. It's just being laid out in front of you in a very open way, with not much polish on it.
It's like, why are we watching films and reading novels? If it touches you emotionally, this is why you resonate with it. And in some stories, you can find echoes of your own emotions. And it depends also at what point in your life you are seeing all these stories. Maybe you are kind of freshly out of the relationship, or maybe you are in a happy marriage, so your experience will be conditioned by what you bring to the party.
This is something that your museum does really well. I feel like it displays something that is like genuinely human and that connects us all. And I also agree with what you said about how your own age and place in life conditions how you see the exhibition. Because I remember when I engaged with it for the first time, I was in my early 20s and now I'm in my mid-30s. And a lot of the things, I read them completely different now with more and different life experience. And I'm also really intrigued by this combination of the object and the accompanying note. On the one hand, we have the object that feels like almost objective, a kind of material trace or proof of a relationship, while the note offers a very subjective perspective, often tied to a specific moment in time. Do you have any thoughts on this interplay between the physical object and the personal narrative, and how the two shape the way we understand these stories?
So many people would say, so your collection is actually the collection of stories. It's immaterial. But in a weird way, I don't know. I remember, for example, experience where when we had an exhibition in Paris and we came to dismantle the exhibition and the objects were still there. And then first, of course, we took off the objects. And for a moment, I had an opportunity to look at the space with just the stories. And I don't know, it looked like a dead, like a black and white TV. Someone switched off the life. So I don't know. I think that in the relationship between the object, the story, and the visitor, something happens that all three are equally important.
There is a good illustration of that. When we started with traveling exhibitions, then we also tried the different methods of exhibiting, from getting the font size right to getting the text right to getting this exchange between the object and the text and the positioning and so on. And we had the exhibition in it was a kind of hard place to get a grip on. And at one place, it was kind of narrow. So I thought, this will be great. We will just have photos of the objects and text. Really nice photos, professionally done, you know, printed, great. And there was on the wall like 20 of those. And then in this, the next part of the space was the normally exhibited, how we usually do it, the object and the story. And it was amazing to watch people. They would just stroll by. So, like, if the object is not there in a physical form, it doesn't have this, it doesn't resonate.
When people first hear about the idea behind your collection, they probably often imagine objects connected to more conventional, heterosexual, romantic relationships. But in the exhibition, there are actually many contributions that go beyond these norms. Stories of queer relationships, polyamorous constellations, friendships, and even deeply personal losses like someone donating their mother's suicide note. Could you speak about that broader understanding of relationships and emotional bonds within the museum?
I mean, we left the title sort of open, the Museum of Broken Relationships. So whatever somebody thinks constitutes a relationship, an emotional relationship. So it's not just romantic, it's not just family. There is also a disillusion with politics. There is a disillusion with religion.
Even at the museum, we had an exhibit which was a bra of a woman who kind of had a breaking up with a version of herself because she went through the breast cancer. So, but she wanted to share the story. So I think that we've become sort of treasury of the experiences that for a human it's too hard to bear alone, and which involves some kind of split, dissolution, loss. And that's the story of our lives. So in any sense.
A stupid frisbee. 2 years and 2 months. Belgrade, Serbia. A stupid frisbee bought in a thrift store was my ex-boyfriend's brilliant idea for a second anniversary gift. The moral was obviously he should be smacked with it right across the face the next time he gets such a fantastic idea. Since the relationship is now preceded by the word X, the frisbee remains in the museum as a nice memory and expelled negative energy. Feel free to borrow it if you like. P.S. Darling, should you ever get a ridiculous idea to walk into a cultural institution like a museum for the first time in your life, you'll remember me. At least have a good laugh. The only thing you could do on your own.
To examine the relationship between people and objects and the emotional and cultural meanings they embody from an anthropological perspective, I'm speaking with Adam Drazen. Adam is an anthropologist whose work focuses on material culture, design, and the relationships between people and objects. He is currently a professor at the University College of London. Hi, Adam. Thank you so much for being here today. Could you first tell us a little bit about your own research?
So my name's Adam Drazins, and I'm an anthropologist. And I think I've worked on various things. What I'm known for as an anthropologist is design anthropology. So the main work that I do is thinking about how anthropologists and social researchers can work with designers to, you know, design the material world all around us. And within that, my main interest is material culture. So like other people research practices or, you know, what people say about objects or what people do, but they don't always pay attention to the material world. And the interesting thing about the material world is that I've found that when people start talking about the things in their lives, they're really addressing their futures. So, you know, everywhere you go in the world, people kind of work with the stuff around them in order to change, you know, how they see their future unfolding, which is kind of interesting, working with the past, the materialized past, in order to develop the future. So that's, you know, that bit of my work that I normally do in like somebody's home, talking about their kitchens or something, that's what comes through in like in talking about this museum. I think the, you know, the Museum of Broken Relationships, it just shows that everybody's involved in this. You know, in order to create a different future, you've got to do something with this, you know, cuddly toy. You've got to do something with this, I don't know, pair of shoes or something. You know, it's very common, and that's, you know, that's mainly what I work on in design anthropology.
Oh, wow. This is so interesting. I actually never looked at it as a kind of future making.
Well, I mean, it came out of different projects. I started off doing my PhD on cultures of care and consumption in post-socialist Romania. And that was sort of thinking about how people felt, particularly about soaps and toiletries. Everybody in 1990s Romania seemed to be obsessed with cleaning and with shampoos and with perfumes and all sorts of sort of really sensory stuff that was kind of exploding into Romania in the 1990s that hadn't really been kind of smelt and touched and felt before. And it was very clear then that people in post-socialism in Central Eastern Europe didn't really have a word for their own society. It was sort of, we're living after communism, we're living after totalitarianism, but we're not yet quite democratic, we're not yet quite a market economy. So there was all these words for sort of uncertainty. And it was difficult, if you just did research on what people said, to actually nail down, well, what's happening here? It was just sort of uncertain. But if you talked with people about things, it was very clear that they were sort of materialising, putting together like a Lego kit, where they saw themselves going. Like, what is it to be middle class? They would sort of, well, we wear this, we eat this, we do our bathrooms this way. You know, what is it to be this kind of a person?
There's so many more questions I have about your work, but we have to move on to talk about the museum. What do you think makes the Museum of Broken Relationships anthropologically interesting?
Oh, I came across this museum before, but I never really looked into it before this podcast. And then I was looking into it, and I you know, at first sight, you think it's quite superficial, don't you? I mean, you think a Museum of Broken Relationships, I mean, sounds a bit tacky, sounds a bit like jumping on a bandwagon or something. But then it's so interesting as a museum because it shows, like, anthropologically, the need in the world at the moment for museums like this. You know, a lot of the people that have donated objects, you get the feeling that they needed to kind of donate objects. When we're studying material culture, you know, there's a lot of anthropologists and social scientists that think it's quite superficial as well. And would sort of dismiss it in their mind. It's just sort of consumer culture. It's just sort of everyday stuff. But a lot of anthropologists are convinced that there's a deeper truth about human society, and that that truth is kind of immaterial, and that meaningfulness and human relationships are about stability, about the quest for certainty, and that the material world is just a kind of superficial sort of, you know, foam on the top. But I think that the Museum of Broken Relationships, it shows that, you know, these objects should really be taken seriously. We live in a world where the current attempts to sort of subdue objects to material things, to show that they are superficial, that they're not the kind of most valuable thing in life, include the digital revolution, people saying that social media is the most important thing, in economically the notion of the experience economy. So at the moment there's for the last 25 years really, the tendency has been to have museums and shops as well, and high streets that are about experiences rather than about things. Museums, there's accusations of museums that they're slightly Disneyfied, that you're encountering the kind of experience or the imagination rather than encountering the thing in itself. In the Museum of Broken Relationships, they're very real things, and they're things with their own stories, all unique, that oblige you to sort of treat them in a certain way. I can give another personal story if it illustrates what I was going through my mind, what I would have donated to the museum. You probably have a question, don't you? What would you donate to the museum? So when I was in my 20s, I got engaged to a girlfriend from university. We'd been together for, I think, 5 years or something. And we got engaged in the west of Ireland, and we bought this engagement ring in Galway. It was an amethyst ring. It was, for an engagement ring, it was actually quite cheap. It was like £300 or something at the time. And then the relationship fell apart. So 5 years later, I was in a different relationship and finishing my PhD. And in order to be together, I moved to Ireland. And so I had all this stuff to pack up, and I found this engagement ring, which my first fiancé had returned to me. And I looked and I thought, okay, I never did anything with this. Like, how come I never threw this away or something? And I was in a bit of a rush. And I said to my father, I'm heading off. Maybe this ring, you could, take it to a secondhand jewellery place. And my dad, who was very clever, he said, I think you need to do something with that yourself. You know, I don't think I can do anything, which was quite smart of him, I think. Emotionally, he recognised that there's some things in life that you've got to deal with yourself. But it was a bit of a puzzle. Like, why did I still have this ring? What was I supposed to do with it? I was in Bristol at my home, and I said, okay, I'm going to take it to the Avon Gorge, and I'm going to throw it into the river. You know, which is bizarre. I mean, why on earth would you ever feel that you've got to take something to a river and throw it into a river? So I walked over there, and then I was about to throw it in. I thought, I can't throw this ring in. So instead, it's a kind of big lookout point. It's kind of a viewpoint. Everybody goes there. So there were loads of people there. So instead, I tore out like a sheet from a notebook, and I wrote on it, engagement ring, no longer wanted, cost £300. And I folded it up and put it in the box, and I left it there to create some kind of, you know, romantic story around it, and left it and kind of went away. Then quite happily, I headed off to Ireland to my current wife. But, you know, that kind of situation, it's bizarre. Why can't you just throw things away? You know, why do you have to take them to a river? Why do you have to try and palm them off on your parents? What's the deal here with that kind of thing? Why did I have to write the price on to the note? The price somehow was important, and make the point, well, this was not very valuable, but kind of valuable. That's, you know, I think that all of the objects in the Museum of Broken Relationships are a bit like that. They're kind of incomprehensible things where they've come to be very important, but in order to move on, you have to do something with them. And definitely I get the feeling that, you know, there is a need for a Museum of Broken Relationships or something like it all around the world, and that the puzzle anthropologically, I think, in thinking about culture is why, what kind of a world are we living at the moment, whereas there is a need for these kind of institutions? Anyway, that's the story of the kind of ring that's my answer to this question, which you never asked, of kind of what would you donate to the museum and why.
There's an interesting dynamic between our relationship to what the object stands for, let's say a friendship, a love relationship, and our relationship to the object itself, as object in its physical form. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, you can get so philosophical. Like, you talk about a relationship with an object. There's so many kind of anthropological stances on, can you have a relationship with an object? What happens to those sort of relationships? That's kind of the important question to ask at the moment, because the way that people are writing at the moment in anthropology, we're moving to a more relational world. At the moment, people are much more aware or think of themselves much more as products of relationships. But, you know, I think the museum, some of the exhibits are so interesting because they draw attention to the relationships, you know, rather than to the person. You sort of expect an object which is, well, this is my object. But these objects are, they're out of control in that sense. They're, you know, none of them are self-sufficient. They're you know, you've got to have the story behind them. You've got to have the relationship behind them. This classic theory in anthropology of the gift, going back 100 years, some listeners might recognize, like Morse's theory of the gift. I mean, that's intriguing to me because, you know, gift, a present is something where you give to somebody and you say, you know, you don't have to give anything back. You know, it's just freely given. It's yours. But, and they can't really easily say no. You know, you kind of have to accept it. There's different traditions of gifting, but, you know, that's often common. And then you've got this thing, and it's always the other person's thing. So if you give me an object, you know, and then you come around to my house like a year later, I'll probably point to it and say, that's your, you know, that's your card, that's your statue, that's your bottle of wine or something. You know, because I'm constantly remembering it, not as mine, but as yours. It's a really interesting illustration of how social relationships can happen. The objects in this, the museum, they show that. They show, you know, objects are always sort of betwixt and between people, and there's a sort of inevitable connectedness about them, that, you know, even if you don't want to be connected, you somehow have become intermingled.
Why do objects become such powerful carriers of emotional attachment? That was one thing that I was wondering throughout the whole exhibition.
But also detachment, I think, is also important. The anthropology of emotions really took off in the 1980s into the 1990s. And there was a really good bit of writing by Fred Myers, who observed that emotions feel like objects. You know, when you have love, fear, hatred, they're very object-like, they're very material. You sort of feel things inside of you which are quite hard, and they're somehow inside of your body, and yet they're also not you. The feeling of love is sort of visited upon you as if it is a thing. And emotions, you describe them metaphorically, so they feel sort of heavy or hard. Or, you know, anthropologists like Fred Myers have for a long time observed that emotions themselves are like things, and that they've got physicality because of hormones or however emotions are constituted. They've got a material reality. They're not abstract as people think they are. In that sense, it shouldn't be surprising that a little plastic piggy or a, you know, a metal plate or something can be emotional, because they, you know, their things share lots of qualities with emotions.
So the topic of the Anthropological Association this year is desired discarded. I think we already scratched a bit on the surface of that during our conversation, but how would you relate it to the museum?
I started off again thinking the museum was exactly desired discarded, but then I realised it's not, that the desired discarded rubric, it assumes that people are in control. It assumes these sort of discrete moments in an object's life that are, you know, for that one moment it's loved and the other moment it's discarded, which is how it feels. So, but I think desired discarded is invertible. It is also, you know, did the object ever want to, you know, was it ever intended to be mine? Did it ever want to be with me? Also, did the object discard me, or did I discard the object? You know, the people who have donated these objects, they feel slightly out of control, and they themselves, in the broken relationships, many people were put in the position of being discarded, as if they were objects, is the implication. And in the broken relationships, it seems to be a big thing, like who was the active person in the breaking of this? I think that the museum the existence of the museum, it also defies desire discarded, because it shows these objects, they're not actually discarded. They have not gone in the trash. They have been given to a museum. The museum itself is kind of a sort of criticism of the problems of thinking of the world as like a consumer society where, you know, we buy things, we use them, we throw them away. Fast fashion is a good example, that notion of fast fashion. Yes, the museum is full of objects that have not quite been discarded. They've been instead donated to society, you know, donated to the community. I think that the museum really sort of, it challenges desire discarded, because you start off thinking that this is all about desire and all about being thrown away, but it's a sort of deeper journey where the objects lead you into a journey where you realise that, you know, the question that desire discarded is like a model of the world, and you realise that was the wrong model. You know, it's kind of the right question but it's not the explanation that you thought it was. And you've come to a slightly deeper understanding of both desire and discarding are socially complex. They're not individual experiences, they're socially complex.
What does the transition from a private object to a public exhibit do to an object's meaning?
Yeah, from private to public. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because it's so hard to do. I mean, if you look at all the private things in your home, we're very familiar with things moving from the public sphere into private. But then when you look at all the things that you've got, you know, it's very few of them that anybody else would be remotely interested in. You know, the move from the private to public is it's an action. It's an action of social construction. It's an action of community construction, potentially. And if you can hit on something and a way of moving from private to public which makes sense to other people, then you're really onto something. Yeah, this museum is a bit like that. It's like a move from individual meaningfulness to the recognition that meaning comes out of a conversation with other people and that you're not quite in control of it. So the meaningfulness of these objects has always got at least two ends to it. You know, I think old anthropology, you would see objects as symbols. You know, a sort of a key has a certain symbolic meaning and it's discrete and it's fixed. The move from private to public is a move from that situation where something has a symbolic meaning and it indexes a certain category of meaning to a situation where the meaningfulness is a conversation. And it's got at least two ends and it's discursive and it's contested. So the structures of meaningfulness change in that sense, I think, in the move from private to public.
So for those listeners who by now got quite curious about material culture, would you have some literature tips, some book for them that they could read if they want to know more?
There's so much that's written about material culture, but books that are directly about objects and emotion. I published a piece in a book a few years ago called Love Objects, which is edited by Anna Moran. And it's a series of short papers, and each one is about a particular sort of way that objects relate to love. And I wrote a piece in that about people moving from Romania to Ireland, being Romanian, being Irish, and the way that objects can mediate that.
A car side view mirror, 1983 to 1988, Zagreb, Croatia. One night his car was parked in front of the wrong house. He paid for that with his side view mirror. I was sorry afterwards, since the car was not to blame. The wipers also got their share, but they were made of more solid material and stayed on the car. The following day, when the gentleman came home, he told me a weird story about hooligans who tore off his side view mirror and bent the wipers. It was so funny that I was tempted to confess. Still, he never told me where he'd been that evening, and neither did I. It was the beginning of the end of our relationship.
What do you hope visitors take away after seeing the collection?
We have a little cafe right next to it, and sometimes I sit there and nobody knows me, and then I listen to people who come out of the exhibition and they wait for their friends. And the conversation is almost always identical. It first starts with, so which story touched you the most? And then it goes into personal. So what would you give? What would I give? What do you think John would give? And there is always a discussion at the table. It's never, they come out and they start talking about something else. It's always a discussion about what they have just been through. And I'm sure that it makes you think. It makes you think about your own relationships, about your choices, about your life, about your friends, and so on and so on. And I think this is the most that you could ask of art to do, to make you think about something. So I'm happy with this.
Yeah, I would say that you come out of it, that you felt something, that it moved something, that you maybe came out a bit changed, that you become more compassionate and maybe take with you this thought that the strength of humanity is maybe in our brokenness. And I always feel also grateful to all the people who send their stories, and I feel we speak of it like our project, but I've always felt it's not just that we were just like the conduits for something that needed to exist, and that people built themselves by being so open.
So if someone listening to this podcast would like to donate an object to the collection today, what would you like them to think about before letting it go?
I would like them to think about who they are, who they are hoping the story will go to. I don't know. We always encourage the contributors to think about the person who is going to engage with the object, you know. Write down some genuine experience. It doesn't have to be polished. It doesn't have to be structured, you know. But if you are sending to the museum, you are sending to a kindred soul who is going to kind of be with it. So try to imagine someone you are telling it to.
Yeah, just be sincere. Just, you know, get it off your shoulder.
Five Dies, April 1st, 2003, January 10th, 2004, Paris, France. He was a very worried boy in constant need of reassurance. His main worry was boredom. We used to play Yam for hours using these dies. When I roll them in the palms of my hands, it feels like I'm holding his hands and mine. Giving these dies away 9 years later should be a way of giving my heart a new chance, making space for a new partner, new games. Because it's time.